So hello and welcome to another episode of A View from the Top. I'm Adrian Cropley. A View from the Top is a regular podcast from the Centre for Strategic Communication Excellence, where I interview some of the world's leading communication professionals as we explore their career journey. And I tell you, it's not often or every day that I get to connect with a communication professional in Iceland, but not just any ordinary communication professional, but one of our profession's movers and shakers. And I've known Mike Klein for a number of years now. And I tell you, when we get on the discussions, they just don't stop. We both like the edgy part of communication, and I've had people on this podcast before who I think stir up the profession a little bit, and Mike is one of these people, and he would probably say the same for me.
But I would.
Thanks, Mike. But Mike is an intern on social communication consultant with a passion for writing and advocacy. And I'll tell you that we'll talk about that big A word a little later on. But having worked across the globe and gaining business experience in places like Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Great Britain, and the Netherlands, and not to mention also in the US, he's the founder of Changing the Terms, which has been recognized as one of Europe's top PR and communication blogs by the Communication Director magazine, and is an avid speaker at a number of conferences globally. And I tell you, Mike, we meet each other probably in numbers of countries around the world, mostly the US, but I don't think we've ever met each other in our homelands.
No, this much is true.
So welcome to the podcast, Mike. And it's great to have you joining me. Usually what I do is when I start talking to our guests, we look at where they start in the career, but I'm actually going to do it the other way around this time because you and I had this amazing conversation last week about some of the things that you are doing now. So what is it that you're doing now? Now you're back in Iceland. What are some of the things that you're doing in communication now?
Well, there are a number of things that I'm doing at the moment. My practice is called Changing the Terms, and the theory behind it is that if you change the words, you change the terms. You change the terms, you change the rules. You change the rules, you change the game. And if you change the game, you change the future. So there is a direct relationship between what you communicate, how you communicate, the impact you have, and the impact that impact has on the grand scheme of things. And that's really what motivates me as a practitioner, as a communications professional. The work that I do focuses mainly on a combination of internal communications, employee advocacy work, and working with organizations to activate their employees on their organization's behalf. And a fair amount, particularly this year, having gone a little bit back to it, is political communication, which is where I got my start as a communications professional about 30 years ago. So working with a public authority in the Midwest to deliver a $3 billion flood protection program for the state's largest city.
Oh, wow. So political communications is where you all started in your career. How'd that all come about?
Well, I mean, the big answer basically was that I was lousy in sports when I was a kid. And so rather than soldier on in the lower depths of kiddie baseball or football, I was growing up in the U.S., grew up in the Chicago area. There was it was in a congressional district, a parliamentary seat, if you will, that was always very competitive. And both the Republicans and Democrats, recruited the kids to volunteer in the campaign offices to do, you know, various menial tasks, but to do things that would free up other resources to help get the respective candidate elected. So when I was 13, I was volunteering, folding shirts in the campaign office of the Democratic congressional candidate. Oh, wow. And I pretty much stayed in politics from then until I went to London Business School for my MBA back in 96. So that was about, you know, almost 20 years of voluntary and ultimately professional involvement in politics that took place before I even begun to think about business communication. You know, it's a my political background is really what guides me in everything that I do in internal communication. It guides a lot of the writing and the thought leadership that I do. And it provides the background for a lot of the insights that I share with my clients and with people in the field.
So did it feel quite naturally going in to do the MBA because you had that bent towards business, having that kind of political background? Is that was that the motivating factor to do an MBA?
No, it was exactly the opposite. It was reaching a point in my political career where I was enjoying it and I was doing great work, but there was a very seasonal nature to it. Yeah. And I was wanting to have a more commercial career, and I wanted to figure out how I could commercialize my political experience. And I also wanted to figure out how to get out of the U.S. because I'd lived everywhere to live in the U.S. I'd lived in the West Coast. I'd lived in the South. I'd lived in the East Coast. I grew up in the Midwest. There really weren't many urban thrills left for me. And I was married at the time with my first wife, and she also wanted to live abroad. And so we applied to different schools, and I managed to get into London Business School and leapt at the opportunity when it was offered.
That's fantastic. So you are, I guess, newly married, moving to a new country, settling down in Britain. How did you find that?
Well, I mean, I loved London Business School. It was the best atmosphere, the best group, one of the best groups of people I've ever been involved with, the MBA class of 98, many of whom are still close friends, and many of whom have gone on to bigger and better things. One of my classmates, for instance, is the CFO of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, Tark Robbiati. There's other CEOs, CFOs, C-level folks in the class. And, you know, it was good to get to meet and connect with these folks. I mean, you know, some of it was a struggle. I mean, I kind of viewed my finance classes as near-death experiences, but I managed to overcome that and managed to graduate with everybody else. But what I got out of the business school, ultimately, in terms of what I learned, was the vocabulary and the philosophy of business and of people who work and lead in the business world. And it was similar but different from the political world. And I was able to identify what the differences were and what the similarities were to be able to make me reasonably effective in working with these folks.
It's interesting how many communication professionals will do the whole comm stuff first, then maybe developing those skills in the business, and that's when they elevate themselves to senior roles or even go into, like yourself and myself, into business. So when was it that you actually made that leap into, and I guess there is a very close link between politics and communication, but when did you make the link after doing your MBA into pure comms?
It started by between the 2 years of the program when I spent the summer working with Eli Lilly's business in the United Kingdom. And they tasked me originally with doing an external communications audit. And I said I would take the role if I could do both internal and external. And they agreed. And it was a fascinating experience because the organization mainly drove its selling through a sales force. And no one had really brought up the distinction that your sales force is actually your leading communications function. It's actually your leading, face to the world. And this is where this whole concept of internal and external convergence, which has been a source of never-ending drama for internal communications folks and PR folks in the Anglo-Saxon world particularly, because there's nervousness about the legal implications, the privacy, and all of this nonsense. The fact is you have people who are representing your business who need to know what's going on in your business in order to represent your business adequately. And conversely, you know, the extent to which your people are seen as credible is the extent to which you're seen as credible. What's funny about Iceland, you know, I've been living in Iceland for the last 6-7 months. My now wife is Icelandic. And here, they've been integrating internal and external communications for years.
Yeah.
You want to you want to get something into the newspapers, you publish it on the intranet. You want to get something, you want to get your employees to see that something's serious, you publish it in the newspaper. And that's just routine here.
Right. And so that's a, that's given within the culture, and that's an accepted way of getting information from an organization.
It's more than accepted, it's desirable.
Because isn't it funny how long we kind of fought that and said the, you know, the divide, and also, you know, coming from an internal comms background myself, is that we must let our people know internally before we go externally and things, but when it's part of the culture and the fabric, we go, well, this is what we do. So it's so fascinating. Did you find that a big change when you moved to Iceland?
Well, I don't work with Icelandic clients at this point, so this was really more in an article that they had published in Communications Director magazine back in 2019, when I was looking for some insights about, okay, what's interesting and different about things here versus the rest of the world. Because the local practitioners I speak with talk about how far behind they are everybody else. But in fact, they're actually far more advanced in a number of areas, not the least of which has been the almost neural integration of internal and external communication channels. The key thing about the integration of internal and external communication channels, though, is it does not negate the difference between internal and external communication. Yeah. Internal and external communication are played by different rules for different purposes. They need to be played well together, but they're not the same thing. And I've been hearing from PR people and, you know, directors of comms that, you know, why don't we just get rid of this distinction of internal communication? Yeah. And it's like, that's absolute nonsense. Yeah. And it's something that produces supremely negative results with your employees.
It's just fascinating how that thinking is so different, and it kind of taps into every country you talk to. They go, oh, you know, we're further behind than everybody else in this space, and it's only that people don't realize the difference in how that works for their particular stakeholder group, their audience group. And it's fascinating how that you know kind of plays out in the different cultural contexts, and some good observations there. What were some of the, I mean, going back to some of your earlier career stuff? So out of London Business School, I know what took you to Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands. Was that just you took your business on the road? Were there different organizations that you worked for?
Well, what happened basically was that after business school, I spent a couple of years with a London firm called Smythe Dorward Lambert, which together with the marketing and communications agency, MCA, were really defining internal communications as a professional consulting field around the turn of the century.
Yeah.
And so it was a big thing to work for SDL. There's a lot of SDL alumni who are scattered in very senior roles. You know, it was John Smythe's firm. So, you know, those who remembered John Smythe, that was, you know, his vehicle for kind of, you know, being that arch trailblazer in IC. And it was great to work with him and his team for a couple of years. But after that point, I joined a dot-com consultancy. And this was back in 2000, just as the dot-com business was cratering. And so I had a bit of struggle for a couple of years, you know, working, you know, basically trying to hold on to some old clients as the whole dot-com world was cratering. Mm. And then I had this immense break when I was invited to work with a company called EasyJet, the British low-cost airline, to drive their internal communication during an acquisition of a low-cost competitor called Go Airlines, which had been originally part of British Airways. And I never learned so much. I never enjoyed working in internal comms so much. And a lot of what I do now is based on some of the stuff that I was able to pioneer with EasyJet. I mean, even, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote an article about how we communicated through paper newsletters, knowing that only about 30% of the people would read the paper newsletters. Uh-huh. and how we accepted that as fact. And what was funny was that I never had a term to describe the phenomenon until COVID came about. Everybody was talking about herd immunity, that, you know, if X percentage of the people got vaccinated, the disease would go away. Well, what I realized that what I was doing at EasyJet was something called herd virality, which was trying to find the minimum number of people you needed to reach in order to make sure that people in the organization knew what was going on. And it was a lot less than 100%.
Yeah.
And most internal communications strategy still kind of acknowledges a belief that everybody should be involved, everybody should be engaged, everybody should be reached. You know, internal comms measurements are about clicks and views and, you know, trying to figure out what percentage of 100%. But most, you know, the reality is you're never going to get to 100%. You might only need to get to 3% if you know who the 3% are, which is, you know, the area of organizational network analysis. Or if you find, say, 30%, which gives you enough coverage and has people who are at least well known enough to be seen as credible and informed. And that's what I learned at EasyJet. And that's been kind of the governing principle of all of my internal comms work going forward. And, you know, some of it's a challenge because if you don't quite have the vocabulary to describe the phenomenon that you're talking about, it makes for some very stressful conversations.
Do you think sometimes we get to be, in internal comms, we get to be too much like perfectionists, that it's we need to tell everybody the exact message, otherwise nobody will get it and things like that, rather than leaving it to that viral communication where it goes out there and people are telling each other, well, I read the newsletter, or didn't you get that update? And they're educating each other out there. And it's quite an interesting learning that you got out of that, is that we don't have to go for the high percentages of hit rates and how many people opened it and did they read it and all that, when particularly if that communication is still getting out there with minimal numbers.
I don't think that internal communicators as a species are inherently perfectionistic, but we tend to work for people who are very exacting in terms of things like technical execution and skills.
Yeah.
And that's because, by and large, we're working for directors of communication, heads of communication, and chief human resource officers.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's strong elements in both of those professions towards, you know, highly polished technical execution, A. But B, both of those roles in most organizations are very much support function roles.
Yeah.
And support function roles tend to be very defensive in their orientation.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've realized just over the last couple of weeks, looking at my business and looking at where I've been most successful and where I think communications, internal communications people have the greatest opportunity for success going forward, is to seek opportunities to work with other C-level leaders who need pragmatic solutions to their problems. Yeah. The CFOs, the chief operating officers, the chief technology officers. Because I think we're in a position to help them far more with far less struggle once we can get them into the conversation.
And it is about having conversations with that group of people where you start adding the value, because you're starting to remove some of the problems that they have inherently by understanding what it is that they're trying to achieve for the business. We educate ourselves on the business. And I guess for somebody like you, Mike, where you've had that business bent and that business background, and because you're a very strategically focused communication professional, those conversations are not so much easier to have, but they come much more naturally to you to be able to do it. So what, thinking about that, what are some of the tips you would share with communication professionals for adding value? Because what you're starting to touch on now is you know, getting those conversations with those people. But how do you get to those people? What's the value you have to add in an organization?
Well, I think the first thing you need to do is take a step back. If you're a mid to mid senior in-house internal comms person or a mid to mid senior freelancer, your workday is probably occupied with doing a lot of executional stuff, and you're probably feeling pretty overwhelmed about it. People in the field talk about, you know, if they're working, they talk about how busy they are. And the key thing you have to do is you've got to find the 20% in your 120% schedule to break through the endless treadmill of just simply doing executional stuff and trying to perfect it and trying to get it past your main boss.
Yeah.
You've got to find it within your heart or within your schedule or within your network of relationships to go beyond and seek opportunities to support people who need your help, A, and B, don't think they know how to do their job better than you do.
Yeah. There's a lot of them around, Mike.
Yeah. And I mean, that's been one of the big problems in working with a lot of, you know, PR-oriented comms people or, you know, to a lesser extent, senior HR people. You know, PR-oriented comms people think it's about maximizing your reach, maximizing your audience, you know, and not having any visible errors. Your HR leads are often looking at, you know, how do you, you know, drive your engagement scores and stuff like that. Because they're still living in the world of, you know, management by engagement score. And a lot of that doesn't map onto delivering substantive, measurable impact to the operational side of the business, to the commercial side of the business.
Yeah.
And the other thing is a lot of it doesn't measure in anything that's quantitatively valuable.
Yeah. Absolutely agree. So, Mike, what's thinking back to Rita? I know you talked about EasyJet as a great stepping stone for you, as it propelled your career. What was the best job you ever had throughout your career, and why?
I'd still say it was EasyJet. Yeah. You know, and it's slightly sad because it was 20 years ago, and I've had great experience since. I think the most interesting job that I had was working with a company that's now called Vion, was with them for around 4 years as their senior editor, working with mobile phone companies in 14 different countries, most of which ended in Stan: Kazakhstan, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, former Soviet Union countries, South Asian countries, and a few countries in the Mediterranean. And, you know, it was, countries with completely incompatible language systems, cultures, and yet we created, A, a functioning company, and B, a functioning approach to internal communication, which was, again, built out of having a recognizably small group of leaders communicating with them in English for consistency's sake. And then having them spread the message in local language in their environments.
It was all about that localizing of the message, the tone, the delivery. And I think this is where some of the big corporates, you know, because you and I are the same era in internal comms, that really are trying to go, we've got to drive the same message to everybody no matter where they are.
One of the things that I'm doing right now is an initiative called We Lead Comms, which is identifying communications leaders, and particularly internal communications leaders from around the world. And as I'm doing that, I'm doing my own podcast also for SMARP as well, which is the employee communications technology vendor that I work with on an exclusive basis. And, you know, we're really getting underneath the need for localization and the need to balance the desire for globalization with that need for localization, and the recognition that the localization need really comes first in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. It would be remiss of me not to take an opportunity when I'm talking to somebody like you, Mike, that is a strategic thinker, to say, internal comms, where is it heading? What do you think is the next evolution of internal comms?
We're about to go into some really heavy turbulence over the next 2 to 3 years. And I've written an article about it on LinkedIn called 2023, Time to Prepare Now, yeah, which we'll be happy to share a link with you and with your listeners. We're seeing a number of different things go off in different directions. We've got the future of the workplace, remote hybrid working from the office. There's a lot of energy that's being put into getting people into hybrid situations. I personally believe that within 2 or 3 years, we're not going to be talking about hybrid anymore. Yeah. We're going to be talking about a mostly work from office model, maybe with a day of flexibility a week, yeah, or fully remote organizations. I just don't see any business models which are going to support having people come into and out of offices when they feel like it.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of real estate that's involved, the amount of management that's involved, and the fact that, you know, the business world before the pandemic was really consistent about one thing, one single thing, which is to eliminate and squeeze out as much slack in the system as possible.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden we're going to create these workplace systems with unlimited slack.
Yeah.
And assume that every other competitor is going to do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And the reality is it's not going to happen because remote and work from office have their competitive advantages.
Yeah.
Work from office has proximity, has the ability to drive multi-generational learning very quickly. Remote or heavily remote, you know, gives you lower overhead costs and access to the global labor market. Hybrid gives you none of this.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And so the issue is going to be, particularly for organizations that are going all in from hybrid now, is how are they going to walk back either towards a fully remote or towards a work from office model? That's going to be a massive issue for internal comms. The second big issue for internal comms is going to be, you know, can internal communications people drive the strategic value repositioning of our profession? Can we get the business to recognize what we can actually do? And the initial reports aren't good. You know, we're hearing about companies adding well-being to the internal comms portfolio.
Yes.
And Bupa, the big British insurer, has a director of internal comms and well-being.
Yeah.
You know, that's like having director of internal comms and logistics.
Yes.
You know, two slightly related but largely different to deliver fields, both of which are important, but having to balance between the two for importance is absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And that's you know, so it's, but it speaks to a view that internal comms doesn't do anything better than just take care of people.
Yeah.
And not that that's a bad thing, but that's not what companies are in the business of doing.
Correct. Yeah. It's fascinating. And I literally dying here to sit down and have a longer conversation around this, about internal comms, its future, and how it is going to go through another, well, it's constantly changing, but it's going to go through another kind of rethink about what it is and what it delivers. The same as we've done, you know, as digital came in, the same as we've done when we first tried to get the whole seat at the table when internal comms was first around. And there was always these things that would start changing and evolving comms as we have events happen in the world. So whether it's a change of technology or now with COVID and the different positioning of the workplace, And it's always fascinating to see what comes out the other side of this. So, it's, I always say there's never more an exciting time than now in internal comms, but I've probably said that maybe three times in my career in internal comms. Before we close off, what I would love to do is give you an opportunity to just reflect a little bit on your career and share any tips with our listeners around what were some of the things you would advise them to do to really, advance their career in communication.
There are so many different types of communication careers. There are in-house careers, there are consulting careers, there are academic careers. And I think the key thing is, instead of deciding what kind of career you want, decide what kind of impact you want to make.
Yeah, love it.
My impact is really around being the individual, being the catalyst for driving, identifiable change. Yeah, I want to get the credit for it. Absolutely. And, that probably makes me make less great decisions in some areas than it does in others. But it's like, for me, it's like my sport. It's like, I want to score goals. I want to set up assists. I want to be the person or be at the source of the innovation, the success, the delivery. A. B. My passion, my real passion over and above that is for the profession itself, is for the people who work in this profession, for the people who also do that with me and with organizations. And that's what's brought me into, and at the same time, into a critical relationship with IBC, for instance, because IBC is largely a community of people that's interested in this. But at the same time, IBC has its own issues and sometimes needs to be challenged from time to time.
Yeah.
When in terms of its ability to look out for the people who do this very important critical work that ultimately transforms life itself. So that's kind of my motivation. So that's kind of driven me to a somewhat nonlinear career path.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wish I had a more linear career path. Sometimes, I wish I had more material wealth or more, institutional influence than I do. But on the other hand, it's like being able to get up every day and think, wow, can this be the day when I hit it out of the park?
Yeah.
That's what gets me up in the morning.
And I don't have to say I'm smiling as you're saying that, because your passion absolutely shines through. And for somebody that started and said, well, I got into political communications because I wasn't sporty, to hear how many goals that you are kicking on wanting to make that difference and hit it out of the ballpark tells me that, the sport was there, but it was in the sport of making a difference in the profession. And that's truly what you've done, Mike.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It also comes from the fact that my dad is the former sports writer for the Wall Street Journal. Sports and sports supportership have never been an option in our family. It was always mandatory.
Yeah, I would resist against it too. I was a bit the same. But Mike, it's been great having a chat to you, and I could talk for hours, but we'll wrap it up there. And thank you for joining me in this episode.
My pleasure.
And that's it for another episode of A View from the Top. It's been great sharing this episode with you, and I look forward to sharing you the next episode of A View from the Top coming up.